Hi, I'm Anna Williams.
And I'm Charity Nebbe. Welcome back to Lit City, Iowa Public Radio's literary podcast.
Today, we're talking about the humble origins of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, which is now and has been for decades the top-ranked creative writing program in the nation.
It was also the very first creative writing program in the nation. And to kick off this conversation, we talked to Lauren Glass. He's professor in the University of Iowa's Department of English and Center for the Book. And he's also kind of the resident go-to guy about the workshop's history. Right now, I am on the banks of the Iowa River in Iowa City. Lauren, thank you for standing out by the river with me.
Glad to be here.
Now, back when the workshop first started in 1936, they didn't really have room for it, right? So this is basically the site of the beginning of the Writer's Workshop. How did it start?
That's correct. The University of Iowa Writer's Workshop initially was housed in a series of Quonset huts on the banks of the Iowa River. Very cold in the winter, very hot in the summer. And until the building of EPB, that was where all of the workshops were held.
English and Philosophy Building. We're right outside the EPB right now. The Quonset huts, I realize they didn't have a lot of space, but did that also say something about the speculative nature of the Writers' Workshop? Was this something that was a bit of an experiment?
Indeed. Learning writing at the university was not at all what writers in the first half of the 20th century would have thought of doing. Hemingway would have scorned it. And indeed, when Paul Engel first started the creative writing workshop, there was considerable skepticism, if not indeed scorn, of the very idea of being taught writing. There's still a question as to whether writing can be taught, although certainly it is taught. And yes, it was a marginal speculative enterprise. Really only sustained by Paul Engel's fervor and determination.
So after the Quonset huts, the EPB was built and the workshop moved in there for a long time, right?
At least three or four generations of writers have been trained in the seminar rooms of EPB, and indeed EPB has inserted itself surreptitiously, sometimes under other names, into a whole variety of novels and memoirs and even poems before Dye House was established as the home of the Writers' Workshop.
So give me some examples of where this site, the banks of the Iowa River and the EPB show up in some novels that so many of us have read.
Certainly the most famous appearance is in The World According to Garp, when, if I remember correctly, Garp is looking out the window of the building and sees the pickup truck in which his wife is being carried off. I believe it's not called EPB, but there were details of the building that made it obvious to anyone who was familiar with the building that that was the reference that was being made.
Well, Lauren, thank you so much for introducing us to the workshop this afternoon on a gray, gloomy day on the Iowa River. Lauren, thank you.
You're very welcome.
So one of the other cool things about the Writers' Workshop, besides all of these amazing students that it has drawn in and have gone on to be the top names in American literature, also the professors that the workshop draws to Iowa City, people like Marilyn Robinson, Ionna Mathis, who was also a student and went on to become a professor, Robert Lowell, Claudia Rankine, Philip Roth, and one of my personal favorites, Kurt Vonnegut.
And one of the professors who is currently teaching in the workshop is Ethan Kanan. He's also, believe it or not, a physician, in addition to being a celebrated author. And I sat down with him back in February of 2016 to discuss his most recent novel, which is called The Doubter's Almanac. It's a novel that tells the story of four generations of one family, and at least one person in each generation is gifted with mathematical understanding and abilities that you could really only describe as genius. And this genius is both a gift and a curse. Hello, Ethan.
Hi, Charity. Nice to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here today. Whenever I tried to write a brief summary of this book in effort to introduce it, I found myself frustrated. This is a very complicated family saga that, as I mentioned, goes for generations. But maybe you can introduce us to one of the main characters, Milo Andret, and tell us a little bit about him.
Well, Milo is a kid, grows up a solitary kid up in the northern part of Michigan. He grows up, spends a life in the woods. That's kind of a kid's life in Michigan. Unaware that he doesn't really have any friends, unaware that the world is sort of his own to discover. And as a kid, he stumbles upon some sort of interesting mathematical properties of this and that, and ends up having a real talent for this that he's unaware of. And later becomes a prominent mathematician and starts on the journey of trying to solve the unsolvable problem, which becomes the defining force in his life. And the book, you know, is really about his life, all of it, start to finish, and the effect he has on his children and on his children's children, and the effect that great ambition has on not only a person, but the people around that person. And it sort of, the book just sort of spread from there, like, I discovered the book as I write it, and it spread for me out from that sort of central task that he sets himself to.
Would you read a little bit for us from, this is toward the beginning of the book, when Milo is still a young man?
Sure. This is something that happens to him when he was 13 years old. Actually, I had a long debate with the copy editor, but I'm still not really sure the answer, because the first phrase of this is, one night during the summer of his 13th year. Now, technically, during your 13th year, you're 12. But that was but most people don't think of it that way. So I guess he is 12 here.
All right.
One night during the summer of his 13th year, a windstorm swept down the straits, and he was awakened in bed by a crashing from the woods. The next morning, at the edge of a ravine, he came across a stump that was as wide across as a tractor tire. It was a beech tree broken off at the level of his waist. The rest of the tree lay several yards away, neatly divided into three, as though the immense thing had been scissored up, carried off to a safe distance, and placed down for his inspection. He took a seat on the rim of the broken base. For the whole morning he sat there, contemplating what had presented itself to him, until an inspiration arrived. He spent the rest of the summer executing his idea. Over the long days of July and the shorter ones of August and September, he hardly came in from the forest. He found that he could work for 10 or even 12 hours at a stretch, so that by the time fall arrived, he realized that he'd produced something miraculous. It was a single, continuous loop of wooden chain, more than 25 feet long, carved out of the top of the stump, and resting above it on hundreds of tiny spurs that had been whittled down to the thickness of finishing nails. The chain coiled in a tightening spiral toward the center of the tree, then doubled back and coiled out again toward the rim, returning to the spot where the last link closed around the first. He carved a twist into each of the links, which produced a startling effect. If he ran his finger all the way around the surface of any single one of the links, the finger would circle not once, but twice around the twisted link before returning to its starting point. This strange fact felt like a secret to him. Finally, one peat-scented evening in the warm October of 1957, he understood that he'd finished. He'd needed his creation to be perfect, and now it was. One last time, he ran his hands over the length of it, feeling for flaws. Then he severed the spurs and meticulously sanded away their nubs. At last, he lifted the whole thing into his arms, doubling it around and around his shoulders until the slack was gone. It felt like a living thing now, yet it was as smooth and heavy as stone. When he inhaled, it tightened around his chest. Standing in the quietly darkening woods, as the lights began to come on in the distant house, he felt like an escape artist preparing a feat.
That's Ethan Kanen reading from his new novel, A Doubter's Almanac, introducing us to the character Milo Andretton. And this is when he's a 12-year-old boy, and so he's out there in the woods. He spends so much time carving this chain, and a normal 12-year-old child, well, A, wouldn't have done that. B, after completing a feat like that, would want someone to know about it. But he doesn't.
He's a secretive kid, and maybe that is, in the end, one of his downfalls, in that he didn't feel that overwhelming desire to connect that a lot of kids feel. He is a connector in a funny way. I mean, he's in some ways he's not. In some ways he's a desperate man living only in his head. But he also feels a need to be with others, and that's the conundrum that devastates him as he finds himself more and more in his own mind as he gets older.
His mathematical genius is expressed in a number of different ways, but he doesn't find a way to apply that genius until he's in his 30s, really. Yeah. I mean, after he...
Which is quite late for a mathematician, generally speaking. You know, the mathematicians will debate this with you until you both turn blue, but there's this idea that if your work – it's kind of like gymnastics. If your work isn't done at 18, it's over, which is a terrible weight hanging over people in a field like that. I'm lucky to be a writer when generally in that kind of field, the more you experience, the more you know of life, the better you get.
He winds up going to graduate school in his 30s and where he commits his life to solving this unsolvable problem. But – in the meantime, what he's been working at a service station, we don't see much of him in this interim period, yeah. But there is a reference to what he's been doing.
Yeah.
And that struck me as really interesting because this genius for mathematics for him is in many ways it's almost like a lightning bolt striking him. It's not mm-hmm. something that he's worked at and built up himself. This is almost an other kind of gift.
Yeah, or you can say that he was unaware of his limitations, being a solitary kid. I've seen that. I'm sure you have too. You see these kids often who are homeschooled, kids often who grow up on farms. They don't realize that you're only supposed to know a certain amount at a certain age. And you get kids quite young, you know, learning calculus and learning all kinds of math because they're not in school. They don't know that it's way above them. you know, it always makes me wonder about, you know, human potential. I'm also a doctor. I was trained as a physician, so I spent a fair amount of time working in big city emergency rooms. And one of the things that always – probably the most impressive thing I've ever seen, and I've seen it multiple times in emergency rooms, is people in the throes of manic psychosis who are flat-out brilliant. I mean verbally – they almost seem like creatures of another species. Their verbal inventiveness and their the lightning rapidity with which they can string words together, make them sound good, make them meaningful, make them seem apparently true. I mean, it really gives you a glimpse into, you know, what the mind is like underneath its layers of constraint.
Well, and the way that his mathematical abilities work, it almost seems like he never has control over them. Was that something, I mean, thinking of those people at the emergency room, was that something that you had in mind with this character, that his abilities controlled him more than he controlled them?
Yeah, I mean, think of what your mind is like and think of if the times in your life when your mind has been slightly out of control and thinking about things you don't want it to think about and trying to stop it from thinking about those things. And then imagine your mind were really a muscle man's mind or a muscle person's mind and really unstoppably strong. And if that mind gets out of control, it's a frightening thing. And I think most people have had that experience of generally being in control of what you think about with the occasional disruption in which you can't control your mind. It's a frightening thing. It's sort of like being at the wheel of a locomotive, you know, and being unable to brake it.
But at the same time, he needs that out of control cycle to solve his problem. So he also has to figure out some way to tap into that, even though it's not something he fully understands.
That's the flirtation that with danger that I think original thinkers have to engage in every day. You know, people think of math as being or a mathematician as being someone who can solve a very, very difficult problem, who can just sit there and do calculations. But it's not that. I mean, you know, I'm no mathematician, but I've thought about it enough to realize that it's not about having the brute force to get through a morass that others can't get through. It's actually about something very different. It's about taking something undoable that's humanly impossible and thinking about it in a thousand different ways until you find the way that it is doable. It's not about slogging your way through something. It's about elegantly dancing around it until you see its vulnerability approaching it that way. And that's the ingenuity of math. You know, the same thing happens in any sort of art I've seen. It's dancing around until you find an entrance.
We were talking about your main character, Milo Endret, and how he is in many ways controlled by his abilities as opposed to controlling of his abilities. And one of the things that he struggles with throughout his life, and this is something that other members of his family also struggle with, is addiction. And there seems to be throughout history a lot of connection between genius and addiction. Was that something that inspired you about this character? Did you think, you know, here's someone who is so in touch with the ether or trying to touch the ether that substances would be appealing to him because of that?
You know, I never anticipate or think about things like that. It's just the character is the character, and you just sort of, try to dream it into existence. I did have the experience. I know mathematicians, as a rule, are, you know, unpleasantly disposed towards this idea that they're prone to mental illness, prone to addictions. And, you know, I was on the radio in San Francisco a few days ago and somebody called in and said, you know, in my experience, he was a mathematician, I think, he said, you know, if you talk about the ones who are addicted and antisocial and behave badly towards others, you know, when I think of that, I think of writers. And I have to say, he was so articulate about it, I just had to laugh because he's right. But, you know, I think there is something about – it's not necessarily about genius – but I think it is about concentration. If you are concentrating so fiercely on this grail, this holy grail in your life, whether it be a mathematical problem or a novel or a piece of music or a painting, that it's difficult to keep your mind on the other things, like putting your pants on the right way and, you know, buttoning your shirt and taking care of the people you love and taking care of yourself. Those things tend to fall sideways.
Now, I don't think I'm giving anything away by saying that part of the way through the book, we learn that the voice of the narrator is actually the voice of Milo Andret's son, Hans, mm-hmm. who also has these mathematical abilities. And Hans gains insight into how his father's mind works, and he shares that with us, the readers. Can you read a little bit? That gives us a little bit of an understanding of Milo's mind.
Yeah, as you mentioned, this part is something that is spoken by the son of the – whatever you want to call it. People call it a protagonist, which I find kind of a strange word, but the narrator of the book. This is his son. His name is Hans, thinking about his father, the great mathematician. And being almost entirely unaware of my father as a person – I was almost entirely unaware of myself as well. Yet I somehow knew enough about him because I somehow also knew enough about myself to understand that his uncompleted thoughts were the lifeblood of his being. This was why I stayed away from those boxes. I should mention that both he and his father do their work and then hide it in a box. They put it in a box overnight sort of to marinate and then look at it the next morning. This was why I stayed away from those boxes. His thoughts were the ship on whose prow he stationed himself while the ice-strewn seas leapt and dived below. They were matters of calculatedly outrageous assumption, elephantine diligence, missile-like prophecy, and an unending, unruly wager regarding their eventual worth. They were going to be attacked with branching, incremental logic and met after months of toil, if not after years of it, by either the maniacal astonishment of discovery or by the shame-tipped dart of folly. The fact of all this was like genetic information inside me. I knew it even as a teenager. I knew it even as a teenager on a substituted and tactogenic amphetamine. I'd probably known it as a child. And I knew equally well that the risk of the toil he now began performing every day upstairs in his new office, despite the apparent risklessness of his quotidian life, might at any time overwhelm him, even more so in his fragile state. I knew that these mortal risks were hidden away each morning, that they were held at bay till the following afternoon by the cardboard tops that he placed over these boxes.
Ethan Kanan reading from his new novel, A Doubter's Almanac. In the book, one of the things that comes back again and again is a connection with the natural world. That's where young Milo, who had no friends and had incredibly distant parents who really gave him very little love or interaction, that's where he found solace in the natural world. And as he began to spin out of control, it struck me that he lost his connection.
To the natural world.
To the natural world.
Interesting that you see that. I mean, you know, these are invented characters, but I have to say that that's my own feeling now as I get deeper into a, say, writing a novel, which is a pretty difficult thing to do, I think it's fair to say, to invent something that, you know, can take you years and years and years. And that is a solitary feature that involves creating something really out of just the fabric of your own mind. I mean, there's nothing tangible to a book, which is sort of amazing that it's just black dots on a piece of paper. And yet if you read it, you have a vision. It's a way of recreating the world, almost like a camera obscura or one of those things where it makes the world upside down inside it. But as I get deeper into these things, and you know, it can be intimidating and frightening and you don't really know where you're going. I always continue to take solace in the physical world. Walking in the woods, you know, chopping wood, all those things that connect one back to the simpler pursuits of humanity.
It was a cycle that I – and maybe because it's something that I relate to, I was seeing it. But also it's a cycle that I saw his son also go through. His son loved to spend time in the woods and in nature and living in Manhattan – I don't want to give too many twists away in the book, but he seemed to lose that connection. He wanted his children to have that connection as well.
Yeah, I sometimes think I must be descended from farmers because the
I think we all are.
We all must be in some way, although maybe hunter-gatherers before
right.
that. At least woods people. You know, I spent some time in Manhattan on this book tour for this book, and you know, much as I love New York, I feel a little pity for those people who live there all the time because they don't get this calm that you get. Just walking outside in Iowa City is, you know, a fantastic, fantastic thing.
The son, who is the voice of the book, is like his father in many ways. He has this mathematical gift. He also shares some of his vices and weaknesses. He tries very hard to choose a different path. And in some ways, we see him making the same mistakes as his father, even though he thinks he's chosen a different path. And, you know, maybe he gets to make different choices as we leave him in the book. But in looking at your biography and knowing that you are a man who went and got your MFA and then you went to medical school at Harvard and became a physician and then returned to novel writing, is that a little piece of you, a person who had to at some point say, wait, I'm on the wrong path. I want to make a hard left turn here?
You know, I know it's popular to say choices now when one talks about life. I've never felt that way. I don't feel I'm making choices. I feel that my life, the lives of most of the people I know are somewhat random collections of circumstances and opportunities. And I guess you can call them decisions, but they seem more to me to be sort of the almost like a mechanical response to the forces, you know. You know, the way the stock market is ruled by fear and greed, you know. One's life is ruled the same way by hope hope and optimism and fear on the other hand. I left medicine because I'd always been in love with being a writer or writing. I've always been in love with certain books. I wanted to do that. And I knew that if I didn't need – but I knew that if I didn't need the money from finishing a book, I would never actually finish writing a book, because that's different from writing. It takes a lot of just labor with a shovel to finish an actual book. And that's sort of why I walked away from writing. I walked away from medicine, excuse me. And I guess in the sense that is a decision. And it's about making the – for me, it was about making the decision about what I wanted most to do. But that's a complicated decision because medicine is also, an incredibly fascinating field. You get exposure. What I loved about medicine was a very similar thing to what I like about writing, is you get exposure to the breadth of humanity in a way that very few people get. I mean, doctors are so and nurses and anybody who works in that kind of field is exposed to a vast range of human behavior, and it's an education in life. It almost seems that it ought to be mandatory for writers to have that kind of education.
The character Milo Andret, if you just describe him, he is many things that a lot of us dislike.
Right.
He is an abrasive man. He's a womanizer. He's an addict. He is not involved with his children. He's a terrible husband. he's many, many things that, if on the face of it, I wouldn't want to know this man.
Yeah.
In the book, you introduce us to him as a child. You create sympathy for this character. We love Milo. And then as he turns into what some people would describe as a monster, there's still this sympathy, this understanding that the reader has for that character. Is that important for you, that the readers can't separate themselves?
Yeah. Well, that's an excellent question. In a way – I've always heard that cinematographers compete with each other, camera people who do the cameras in movies compete with each other by in how they depict an airplane landing, because there's always a scene showing that, the main character has traveled. It shows an airplane touching down and the wheels sort of smoke jumps up from the wheels. And that shows the guy's been traveling. So cinematographers sort of have this little internecine, competition with each other about how you can show that without the same – And, one of the challenges I think I set myself as a writer was to write about someone with a lot of unpleasant qualities and still, portray him with sympathy. I actually love him. I love that character. And some of that might come from my life in the emergency rooms when I saw people of – people who've been in gang fights, people who've been shooting other people, had been shot themselves, people who were did a lot of things that you ordinarily wouldn't like, and understand that they have a story, and that most of that comes from fear. Most of that kind of stuff comes from weakness, not strength. And I have a great deal of sympathy for him, and sort of wanted that. I kind of enjoyed that effect that he does a lot of things that might not be considered sympathetic, but I hope one still finds him at base lovable or at least understandable.
Ethan Kanen, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure, Charity.
That's Ethan Kanen. The book is The Doubter's Almanac. And Anna, this is one of those books where the characters make unbelievably bad decisions all the time. And sometimes I find books where the characters make bad decision after bad decision after bad decision. I just get depressed. And there was plenty in this book to be depressed about, but it also was engaging enough and interesting enough and carried just a kernel of hope. So it didn't leave me just feeling like I could never get out of bed again. It's an incredible read.
Okay. Well, speaking of you feeling depressed, maybe I have something that can kind of cheer you up.
Oh.
I've been kind of poking around trying to find a theme song for our show, and I have a few options. I think you're really going to like.
Really?
Yeah.
Do we need a theme song, Anna?
Well, maybe like for the end of the show, like okay. when you like preview next week and all that stuff. So
okay.
just bear with me here.
Okay. All right. So you have several options?
I have three options. Option number one, here we go.
You think we're cool enough to pull that off?
You know, I figured that one was kind of a long
Maybe
shot.
Maybe you are.
But,
I'm not.
I thought I would just throw it out there, you know?
Okay.
In the city of
right. it does,
literature.
It does say city.
Yeah.
It sure does.
Okay. And speaking, you know, songs that say city, let's go ahead and hear option number two. I think you might really like this one.
All right.
We built this city. We built this city on rock and roll. Built this city. We built this city on rock and roll.
That is completely terrible. I'm just going to veto that right away. I do get veto power, right?
I thought that you might say that. So that's why I've got a third option. Like all things in literature, like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, I'm pretty sure that this third one is going to be just right.
In the city,
well, okay.
Aww.
I think certainly maybe cool enough to pull it off.
You know, this third one is a song I remember hearing a lot in the car with my parents when I was younger. Just like I remember hearing
I'm cool, like your parents.
Public radio
we both are, right?
in the car with my parents.
Well, yeah, we can give it a try. All right.
That doesn't sound very confident, Charity.
Well, we'll see how it works.
Okay.
Maybe you should write something.
You know, I did just get a drum set for Christmas.
I can't wait to hear how that turns
out. It'll just be a drum solo.
All right. So next time, in addition to Anna's drum solo, we are going to talk about some really kick-ass women. We're going to talk to Julie Rubini, who is the author of a book for young people. It's a biography for kids. It's called Missing Millie Benson, and it's fascinating. Millie Benson is the first woman to write the Nancy Drew books. So she is the woman behind Nancy Drew, this whole untold story. And she was from Iowa. And so that's going to be a lot of fun. And then we're also going to hear from Erica Janik, who is the author of Pistols and Petticoats. So, of course, Nancy Drew, one of the most famous spies, sleuths, that's the word I'm looking for, of all time in literature. And Erica writes about many other women who were private eyes, detectives.
In real life and in fiction.
Exactly. It's a lot of fun.
All right. Well, thanks for stopping by Lit City. See you next time.
In the city.